Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Achtung, Achtung, welcome. This is a We Have Ways special, and we are delighted to be joined by a very special guest, Phillips Payson O'Brien, who the author of How the War Was Won. And I think as grabbing titles go, it's not a question, it's an answer, yeah. This book, isn't it? That's the fantastic thing about it. Welcome to the podcast. We talk an awful lot on We Have Ways, and on our Patreon, our listeners and our regular members of what we call the Independent Company are very, very interested in battles. Your thesis is that there's one battle, really, one gigantic battle on sea and in the air, and that the land battles are kind of... And the listeners are going to blanch when I say this, are kind of incidental.
Battles are...
I've boiled that down properly.
I mean, battles are important for telling a story. The experience of battle is incredibly important in war. It's where lots of people die, lots of people do extraordinary things, brave things, cowardly things. So as a story, battles are incredibly important and interesting. What I find... Yeah. problematic, or what I found as I did my research, is tying quote unquote battles to actually victory and defeat, and that, you know, this process by where Japan and Germany were defeated. It all began, I mean, it's interesting. I'm a very slow writer. It took me many years to write this book because I first had the, I mean, it struck me, something surprised me when I was doing my PhD. For fun, I was reading the Strategic Bombing Survey, which right away is probably a sign of a very odd personality, but I was reading the Strategic...
it's not short, is it? Let's face it.
Yeah, but it was fascinating because they had collected all this data on the German economy. Now, my PhD was actually on British and American naval power before and after the First World War, so I was doing it for a bit more for fun. But I saw a chart that said, this is something I didn't expect. And you guys know the Second World War as well as anyone. If I would say to you, 1943, what percentage of the German economy was building tanks? You know, of 100% of German war production, all right? So of that 100% of war production, not everything, just war production, what percentage would you say would go to the building of all Panzers and armored fighting vehicles? Not just Panzers, but, you know, the self-propelled guns, all armored fighting vehicles. What percentage in 1943?
Well, I've read your book, so I now know the answer.
Yes, exactly. Similarly,
but what would you have said? Spoilers. Before you read the book?
30%, 40%. That the Panzer is the thing that epitomizes the German war effort. It's the thing that the vast amount of ink has been spilt over. I mean, it preoccupies the imagination when discussing.
It's about 7%. I mean, it's a tiny, and particularly when you compare it to aircraft, which are over 40%. And when it comes to arming aircraft, it's over 50%. And this just actually sort of blew me away. I have to say, I saw this and I said, this makes no sense when you look at how the Second World War is portrayed, because 43 is this great era of these decisive land battles, be they Kursk, the end of Stalingrad, El Alamein, whereas, you know, the air offensive over Germany is sort of pointless. It's not doing much, not destroying anything. But I said, boy, if you look at the war in terms of what's actually being made by the Germans, who are seen as this big land power, then you have to look at it very differently. And so I just started, you know, I put it aside while I was writing my PhD and other things, and then I came back to it, and I just started breaking it down as to what the Germans were doing. And then I said, okay, look at the Battle of Kursk. Big, big battle. Big, big land battle. Germans lose a few hundred armored fighting vehicles in the first 2 weeks of Kursk. All right. Maybe 300, 400, maybe 500 at most. Well, they build 11,000 that year. And by the way, the ones they lose at Kursk are mostly Mark III's and Mark IV. They're early, they're sort of not the most advanced ones. So the Germans lose 0.2% of their armaments production in the year of armored fighting vehicles at Kursk. 0.2% is their loss of armored fighting vehicles.
Yeah.
But Phil, the start off with the German, we talked about this a bit on the pod, but the German way of war is traditionally, and the Prussian before it became German, is to fight their battles incredibly quickly, with overwhelming strength at the Schwerpunkt, you know, the kind of main point of force, and overwhelm them, so they don't get caught into a long attritional battle because they're stuck in the middle of Europe, because they don't have access to the world's resources, they don't have a big merchant fleet, you know, they can't get to the world's oceans, you know, the Baltic is an absolute mishmash of little channels and islands and is difficult to get in and out of, etc., etc. And so they can't afford a long attritional drawn out war, and what your book brilliantly does is demonstrate that once they got to that situation, and I would argue that's about November 1941, that they're not going to win because they just simply don't have the material strength to do so. So I would say it's earlier than Stalingrad and Kursk and all the rest of it, but that's neither here nor there. The main point is that your book absolutely is just incredible in realigning that importance of air and sea power into the whole conflict, and that it shouldn't be quite so land-centric. I mean, I think that's just fascinating. And really, of course, once that Germany doesn't win outright quickly, then it is about production, it is about reducing mobility and all the rest of it. And the Western allies are incredibly efficient at that, both with Germany and with Japan.
That tiny percentage of AFVs destroyed in the Kursk battle, where were the other AFVs destroyed?
Well, I mean,
then?
The thing is, most losses are the kinds of things of every attrition. They lose a few a day. I mean, so maybe you lose a few more a day during Kursk, and you know, but that's only a 2 or 3 week period. Most losses in the Second World War are attritional. Losses are not the kind of things that you have these one event where you lose everything and then rebuild. Tanks break down. You could have 2 or 3 tanks break down.
Particularly German tanks.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at in the summer, I mean, I don't want to make this too statistical. Summer of 43, the Germans lose 1,300 armored fighting vehicles on the entire Eastern Front. I.e., Kursk is, it bumps it up a little bit, but it's not actually much higher than the average daily attritional loss if you look at what the Germans are doing. And to go back to your point, James, the Germans can't win the war while Britain's in it. I mean, the decisive moment is the Battle of Britain, which is an unwinnable battle.
Yeah.
What I think it
I
is,
totally Ger- agree.
German, the Germans cannot win if they cannot drive Britain out of the war. And they simply cannot drive Britain out of the war. They do not have the right equipment. The only way they might have done it is if they had spent 4 or 5 years from 1940 preparing that battle. I mean, they would have had to completely retool what they have, build what they didn't have at the time. And they might have been able by 1944, 45 to take Britain on. Even then, I doubt they would have. But it's the kind of thing, if that's the German way of war, it's doomed anyway. Now, the German way of war has no way of succeeding.
So interesting. Yeah, because by 1939 to 45, warfare has become a war of air, land and sea. You know, I came across this great quote the other day by Field Marshal Alexander, and he said, you know, modern warfare is a marriage between air, land and sea. The symbiotic relationship between the army, the navy and the air force has to be absolutely tight. And that's what the Western allies are doing. Soviet Union isn't doing it quite to the same extent. Germans certainly aren't doing it. The Japanese are trying to do it. Mm-hmm. And doing it quite successfully to start off with. But you know, he's right, isn't he?
Well, it's also what is engaging the enemy? Is engaging the enemy efficiently killing an enemy soldier in battle? Well, actually, that's the least efficient way to engage an enemy, because by that point, the enemy has a weapon and could kill you. By far, the most efficient way is to use air and sea power to engage the enemy before they can put things into battle. You know, by the time they get to the battle, they can be used to get you. It's far more important if you can actually damage things either before they're made, while they're being made, or while they're being deployed. And that's why air and sea power We operate on a different level. Land power operates in these battle moments when you come together. Air power or sea power, you going back to Mahan or Corbett, can actually affect the process from the minute the raw material is mined from the earth and put on a ship and tried to send to the factory. And so they really determine, by the time you get to the battle, air and sea power have already shaped what's going to happen. If you look at something like Kursk or Alamein, they're not actually moments of drama because we know what's going to happen because air and sea power had to determine what was going to occur in those engagements. There was no way.
Because Montgomery and Alexander have decided that before the Battle of Alamein, second Battle of Alamein on the 23rd of October 42 launches, that their material strength is such that they cannot lose.
They cannot lose, and the Germans can't resupply. Yeah, yep. The Germans are what they are. The British have control of the supply lines. They're going to win the battle.
So at what point have the Allies decided that, or when does the penny drop for the Allies that this is the only way they're going to win? Or is this how they're always, is this just First World War experience, that the air is the next element on top
this
of
is
it? Because after all, the strategic bombing campaigns, that comes out of the idea of the blockade, doesn't it?
I don't want to go into, my next book is about the making, how the First World War affects Second World War grand strategy by looking at Churchill, Hitler, Stalin, Roosevelt, and Mussolini. Churchill has a fascinating, and I'm going to preview the book here. The most interesting period of Churchill is the one period in his career that isn't studied that much when it comes to understanding Second World War strategy. And that was when he is Minister of Munitions in 1917-18. He has this first very tumultuous period in the First World War. He has the Gallipoli disaster. He carries the can for that. He then goes to the front and he sees what war is. And he comes back, and because he's not in the war cabinet, people don't pay attention to him. But he's actually got a really important job. He is Minister of Munitions. And he has to think, okay, what do we need to win the First World War? And there are fabulous memos in the National Archives where he writes down, actually, it's all about movement power, not firepower. I mean, he actually is, he's talking about, okay,
wow.
What we need to do is we need to protect our soldiers. He's against any kind of high casualties. He's saying we need machines. Machines are our way to win the war. And he calls it movement power over firepower. And it's no mistake that as soon as he becomes prime minister, by the way, but Britain's also doing it in the 30s. Britain's investing massive sums in its air force and navy in the 30s. The army's always the poor relation at that point. And Churchill merely...
There's a whole thing about the army. Yeah. Britain's not going to have a large army because to have a large army, you have to have conscription and the public wouldn't put up for it. And also, where do you put them? If you've got an army of millions, where do they go when you're a country like Britain? And how do you move them about? There's a reason why Britain as an island nation has the Royal Navy as its senior service.
Absolutely. And why the RAF actually passes the Royal Navy in funding in the late 30s. When faced with the funding, Britain always funds air and sea. The land becomes, I don't want to say secondary, but it's never going to be the main service. And so the British make that decision very early. The Americans make that decision, I would say, primarily in 1942 when there's a really interesting production crisis for the United States in 42. People think the Americans can build everything they want. They can't. They think they can build everything they want. But in the summer of 42, they find they can't. And they have a real hard brass tacks fight in Washington. And Roosevelt says, that's it. Aircraft number one, Navy number two, Army gets the scraps. And they fight the rest of the war.
That's really interesting because I thought that decision from Roosevelt had come a little bit earlier than that. I thought it's kind of like the summer of 1940 where he goes, the first thing he says is we're going to be making 50,000 aircraft a year, because America starts the war with, I think, it's like 74 fighter planes and that's it, and 50 heavy bombers. And then suddenly there's this exponential kind of explosion in ambition for what the armed forces are going to be, and again, although the army is massively increases in size, the USA in World War II broadly sticks to that same steel not flesh policy, doesn't it, of using machinery,
but that's
to
not
do a lot of the hard yards.
In January 42, when they announced the victory program, they're talking about a 212 division army, an absolutely massive land force. That's the one. By the end of the year, they're talking about the basically 100 division army. They've cut the army in half.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what they stick with. So they almost run out of men. I mean, it's such a I'd say it's a gamble. It's quite a gamble. And in late 1944, they do almost run out of men. That's why in the Battle of the Bulge, they basically have to scrape men off the hotels of Paris to get them into Concord, because the U.S. Army doesn't actually have that many personnel. But that's a conscious choice made in 1942 and reinforced in 43. Air and sea will always win out, and they do.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
There's an awful lot in your book about, inevitably, about Japan and about how this campaign, necessarily against Japan, has to be a sea and air campaign, principally, because there's bugger all land involved, and there's not much land. And, you know, the odd plug of land across the Pacific as you go, but the land battle is the one that has to be avoided, in fact. It is where American strategy ends up, the land battle.
Though it does end up, Japan, yeah, they do end up doing things like invading the Philippines, and there's a real question about whether that's a lot of land. And at one point, early in the war, Marshall's talking about going to China. You know, they actually think that they're going to have to go to China and fight a big land war there, which would have been a disaster. I mean, no, Japan, I think, of course, Japan is going to be the air and sea war non-parallel. It's a much harder war, I think, than people. And again, looking at air and sea versus land, one of the things that got a lot of people, I think, angry about the book is I just actually looked at statistics and made a comparison between the Soviet Union and Japan in 1942-43. Everyone thinks, Soviet Union, big, massive power, a lot of land, a lot of people. Japan, small island, can't do a lot. Well, actually, Japan and the Soviet Union, 1942, 1943, and actually early 44, before the submarines devastate the Japanese economy, they are producing about the same amount of stuff. It's just the Japanese are producing naval vessels and aircraft. And the Soviet Union doesn't have to build a single naval vessel. And you wouldn't want to be in a Soviet naval vessel. So what is happening is the Japanese actually produce as much steel and coal and iron as the Soviet Union in 1942, 43, and early 44. They even produce more aluminum. They can produce. You know, they have in many ways an equivalent resource base as the Soviet Union. They just have to throw it all into the air and sea battle. And I think, you know, to look at it, you know, the Soviets produce more planes overall, though I'm quite skeptical of the Soviet figures because most of their aluminum comes from the United States through Lend-Lease. And even then, you know, Soviet aircraft, if they produce that much, they do so little with them. I mean, the German losses are so minuscule on the Eastern Front, it's hard to reconcile what the Soviets are making. You know, the Japanese increase production rates faster than the Russians from 42 into early 44 when it comes to planes, so that, you know, by 1944, they're producing, I think, 28,000 aircraft, which is a very large number.
This is with a Chinese resource base, essentially, isn't
that
it?
It's the Chinese resource base, and the Dutch East Indies really help. I mean, they put together a very large resource-rich empire in 1942. You know, they had Japan, China, which they'd been expanding into. And then they take over the Philippines and primarily Indonesia today, the Dutch East Indies, Malaya with rubber. If you're looking at a resource-rich empire, actually the Japanese by 42, again, are probably equivalent to the Soviet Union in the resources that they have access to. They don't have quite as much natural iron and steel. Soviets, I mean, the Manchurian steel, iron and steel is not quite of that quality. But for the one thing they have is, I said, much more, say, aluminum. And aluminum is the most... I don't want to get too boring and wonky. Aluminum's the key metal of the Second World War, not steel. Because you can only make aircraft out of aluminum.
Yeah.
You can make the Hurricane out of steel, but the Hurricanes, you don't want to fly in the Hurricane for too long.
You need
aluminum. Yeah,
1940's
exactly.
enough.
You need aluminum to build the really high quality, or you can do the Mosquito, but that's an extraordinary aircraft of a different type. Almost all other aircraft are aluminum.
Yes.
And if you don't have aluminum, you can't fight the Second World War. And the Soviets actually have almost no aluminum. Stalin, when he meets Harry Hopkins, and right after the German invasion, he begs him for aluminum.
I'll tell you what, you're right about those aircraft figures, because they just don't stack up, do they? They really don't. And if you think in 3 months, I think it's 4 months in the summer of 1943, the Luftwaffe loses 7 times the number of aircraft in the Mediterranean.
That's after Kursk.
That's sort of including and after
Kursk. From what we can tell, in many ways, the Germans stopped recording losses on the Eastern Front at different times. Because Adolf Galland is the famous sort of director of fighters, says we just didn't really pay it much attention. So they're sending second-rate equipment to the east. Yeah, they're still sending Stukas in 1944-45 to the east. Heinkel 111s, which fail in the Battle of Britain, they're sending to the east until 1945. So they're sending second-rate aircraft, and I don't want to be too harsh, but really second-rate pilots. If you're a good pilot, you're actually going to be sent to fight the British and the Americans, because that's the crucial ones. So you have all these great, go look at the great German aces. They're all ones who fight on the Eastern Front, shooting down Soviets. Whenever they get transferred to the West.
Yeah, you're getting 100. Well, I mean, we've talked about, on the land, we've talked about Michael Wittmann is a name that came up early in the podcast, of course, the famous Panzer ace from the Eastern Front, who then in Normandy meets his end. And you think, well, is there a quality thing here too in terms of training and all that sort of stuff? Because he's got if you've got the good kit on the Eastern Front, you can have quite a marked effect, can't you? Given the way the Russians are operating tactically. I mean, it's the thing we've talked again, you know, because after all, as your book points out, when you look at the people, look at the loss in terms of infantry, for instance, on the Eastern Front, you go, well, that's obviously the bigger campaign, that's the in terms of human loss, but one of the things we have talked about is how basically profligate the Soviets are with their own people and careless, possibly, you know, and you're running it and that James should point out that the aircraft figures don't really make any sense. Well, after all, we're dealing with a culture that has some an interesting relationship with information and how it's passed on and what it's for and what sort of thing. And that, so Soviet production figures exist in a propaganda sphere as much as they do in an actual.
Well, they certainly don't make any sense sphere, when you look at German losses. That's the hard thing for me to reckon. I mean, maybe they build them, but half of them. That's another thing. Maybe half of them can't fly because they're poorly made.
Well, there was a scandal after the war, wasn't there, with Soviet aircraft safety that embroiled Russian politics for at least a year or so, and you know, another little purge because the planes hadn't been safe and had a high accident rate. So, I mean, these are all part of the same story, I expect. But to go back to Japan, The American submarine campaign against Japan, it really is a by the end of 1944 is a complete stranglehold, isn't it? Nothing is getting
very little.
Yeah, it's amazing that. And it's so little known, isn't it? Why is that?
Well, I think, I mean, in Europe, on the whole, the war on the Pacific, and I will not name names, but if you look at major European historians who write histories of the Second World War, they look at Japan and the war on the Pacific as a sideshow. Go look at the sort of major overworld narratives and see what percentage of them are devoted to the Pacific and what percentage are devoted to Europe, and it's usually 4-1, 5-1 towards Europe. Because the assumption is Japan, it's very much the Germany first mentality has sunk into the way the story is told here. And so that's one. The second is, of course, it doesn't involve... It's why it's a classic. It doesn't involve a lot of people, the battle. It involves equipment. And it's a devastating equipment battle.
Yeah.
But you're talking it involves a few thousand American submariners. For a few thousand men, you are crippling the Japanese economy.
So that's a very efficient way of fighting a war, isn't it? Because you want as few men as possible at the coalface to cause the maximum amount of damage. I mean, that's the whole point of the atomic bomb.
And the most efficient campaign the Germans can fight is the Battle of the Atlantic. And when they lose that battle, the war's over. In fact, it's the only efficient campaign the Germans are fighting in the war. The losses are high as a percentage.
And it's not that efficient because they just don't have enough at the start of the war. I mean, I think it's no more than 13 or 14 U-boats in the Atlantic at any one time on operations in 1940. And that figure's sunk to 6 by January 1941, which is absolutely the crucial time. I mean, the happy time, in inverted commas, of the late summer and early autumn of 1940, where they're kind of making hay. Boy, they really should have been making hay, and they're just not making enough hay, is the truth of the matter. I mean, I think only once did they get over 500,000 tons a month, which sounds like a hideous amount, but when you've got 10,000 merchant vessels and you've got access to around 80% of the world's merchant fleet, that is just no way near enough. You know, why on earth don't they scrap the Zed plan and build 250 U-boats in the 1930s while they got the
general view of some is that Admiral Raeder, who's an old battleship admiral, not a submariner, and he gets Hitler to look at Hitler, who has a very conventional view of the air-sea war, particularly the sea war going into the Second World War, is very much trying to fight the First World War, or almost pre-First World War, German battleship navy. That's Plan Z. We'll take the British on, win the great battle, and that's it.
But they never have a hope in hell of doing that. I mean, just never. It's insane.
Yeah, but you try telling...
It's absolutely insane.
You
it's
try
also big dick
Hitler
syndrome,
that.
Isn't it? I mean, where's the fun in smashing a champagne bottle against the hull of a U-boat when you could be doing it against the Tirpitz? Hitler likes big shit, doesn't he? I mean... He just the bigger the better, as far as he's concerned.
It's why they never. I mean, the real crucial thing is not only they slow U-boat production in 39, 40, 41, is they don't try to make an upgrade in the overall U-boat design till 43.
Type 21 is just sitting there. The technology is there in 1939 for the Type 21. They just don't apply it. It's the one potential game changer that they have.
So the British technology, basically from 39 to 43, increases extraordinarily. When things like the way that the efficient radar, the way the ships they're designing, and the Germans are basically plodding along with the Type 7s and the Type 9s, and then they just get massacred in 43.
God, look how seamlessly we return to the West.
Yeah, look, I'm trying to keep things on Japan, but it's impossible.
Yeah, of course, back to the Pacific.
That submarine campaign needs to be understood because the Japanese economy basically goes into precipitous decline in the second half of 44.
I've got a statistic somewhere, Phil, where it says something like, I think it was something like 87% of GDP in Japan is spent on defense by 1944. I mean, that's just insane.
I would think it. I mean, Japan is the most fully mobilized society, probably even more than the Soviet Union. And when you look at the amount put into the war effort, it certainly is equivalent, if not, they just are throwing everything into the war effort, but they can't compete. It's nothing, particularly once their supply lines are cut.
Yeah, so in a way, you end up with Germany and Japan in a similar state by the end of 44, where their economies are in a precipitous decline. There's no way they can. There's no way. I mean, James thinks there's no way the Germans can win in 41. 43 is the year I always say, middle of 43. It's obviously game over. And if you're doing Clausewitzian decisive battles or moments where you know that there's no way out, you that's the point where you surrender, or you at least sue for peace. Why are, what on earth is going on in, because we've talked an awful lot about Germany and about how the Germans get locked into this Götterdämmerung thing, and that you know that it's the end of the world, it's death or glory, and so we're going to opt for death. What's going on in Japan?
Japanese, on the one hand, the death and glory one is not dissimilar to Japanese ways of war at this time. The Japanese army and navy have gotten Japan in the war, and they can't admit it's a failure. I mean, it's very much a bureaucratic situation. And by the way, the emperor got them in the war too. The greatest cover-up of the Second World War is the cover-up of the emperor after the Second World War. And it's wonderful. You read the Japanese descriptions, the interviews after the war, I can tell you, everyone in the Navy said, oh, we didn't want war, the Army wanted war. And everyone in the Army said, oh, we didn't want war, the Navy wanted war. You know, they threw the buck. But they also, oh, and the Emperor didn't want war either. Everyone, it's almost like they're reading from script. But they all wanted war, they had gotten in. And not only that, even more than, much more than the Germans, than anyone else, they lied to their population about how the war was going. So they had been telling the Japanese population up until 1943, this war is going great. We are just absolutely cruising. And they then can't turn back on themselves. One doesn't want to say it's too much of bureaucracy making a choice, but no one has the ability to change the direction of the war, to stand up in Japan and say, this is over. The civilians are terrified they'll be killed. The Army and Navy don't want to admit they lost, and it's better to wait. Let's see what happens. We'll come up with a strategy. It really won't work, but we'll at least write it down on paper and make it look good. And the strategy is we'll get better terms if we bleed the Americans. So they do. I think people in the know understand the war's lost 43 if you're in Japan. They won't voice it. But what they're trying to do is make the war as bloody and horrible as possible and to get the best possible terms from the United States. They also, I think the Germans might beat the Soviet Union. It's really 40. That's why 40 for the Japanese, what happened? They really go into the war thinking that Germany's about to knock the Soviet Union out. And when that doesn't happen, the entire Japanese strategy is really buggered.
Right, that's all we've got time for with Phillips right now. The rest of this conversation will be on Thursday. Thanks very much.